Because I tried to do that months before, and you wouldn't do it.
Yeah, no, he didn't.
John
he
Carter didn't is the book of my life. As a little kid. Yes. My middle name is Carter.
Yes.
Oh, that's cool.
The whole thing. Well, let's.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sally, by vernacular, you mean in Australian?
An idiomatic speech, almost as if he were telling it, but not quite.
Yes, yes.
It's a kind of rough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, good.
Let's see. Here we go again. Okay. All right, talking to Thomas Keneally, and you are talking now to the students in my class. Would you say hello?
Hello, students, and I hope you're having a great time with these Australian films.
Is it unusual, do you think, for a course at a university to be solely on Australian cinema?
Yes, to the extent that I admire your wrong-headedness and enthusiasm in concentrating on Australian cinema. But there have been, there are great films there by directors who have made great films in Australia and America.
Well, and that 1970 to about 82 period is fertile indeed.
And that is true. And I remember... and this isn't germane for the moment, but I met Skepsi because he brought the script of The Devil's Playground to me in about 1972. And he and I were friends, and he is a man who left school, actually, about the age of 15.
There's a comparable background, I think, between the two of you,
yes,
is there not?
Yes, that's right, in that we're both at an impressionable age in the church. He was studying to be a brother. I was studying to be a priest. And, of course, he escaped, and I escaped. But and that was one of the reasons he knew I'd have the fellow feeling to read his screenplay. But about The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, he approached it, as I said, as a man who'd left school at 15, but who has a great capacity to read a text. I've noticed this also, and I hope you don't mind my dragging his name, in Spielberg. He has a capacity to appreciate a text and to see the film in it. And indeed, there's been some discourse between those two. And in at one stage, Spielberg was thinking of Scorsese as the maker of Schindler's List. And I had dinner with Scorsese. Now, this is a very rare event for me, and I stumble over my words, as I am with you at the moment. But Scorsese told me that The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith is one of his formative movies. When he wants to go back to the springs that refresh him, it's one of the springs he visits. And he didn't seem to be lying either. He knew all about it. But yes, it is written in a fairly brutal language, this book, which then conveys itself to the film. It's also written in the kind of English that Aboriginals speak. I was influenced and have been all my life by the fact that I spent my early years in a town where there was an Aboriginal reservation either side of town. I used to see Aboriginal kids coming past the gate on Friday afternoons when they always came to town to shop. And I was fascinated by the fact that they had to sit in a different part of the cinema.
Oh, interesting.
I was also fascinated by something that will sound funny to you, but my uncle was the, before the days of sewage in this country town, my uncle collected the waste material from toilets. He had a very fancy truck with golden scroll work in which he would carry the creosoted cans, both empty and full. And he collected the waste from the Aboriginal reservation as well. And I thought in my childish way, why is it that a white man can collect Aboriginal toilet cans, but they can't sit near him in the cinema? It was not a moral question. It was one of those questions kids ask themselves. And so my fascination with Aboriginals lasted from that time. I didn't fully understand the culture. I was a bit reckless in writing the book from the point of view of a fully initiated but half European, half Aboriginal Aboriginal.
As is the case with Jimmy. Yes.
And is the case with Tommy Lewis, the man who plays
similar.
Schindler's... monomaniacal. The man who plays Jimmy Blacksmith. It was a time when I wrote it, it was during Vietnam. And you might notice that there's a war going on in South Africa at the time.
Right.
Of the Jimmy Governor, Jimmy Blacksmith. The original
Blacksmith
was a fellow called Jimmy Governor who really existed. So there's a Boer War going on from which troops are kept back to chase Jimmy. The sort of language of the Aboriginals is it's got some Cockney in it. It's got some grammar of their own. It's a sort of reservation English. It's a mixture of Australian argot, and it's not what Aboriginals speak now, but it's what they spoke then. And, of course, I was fascinated by the part that totemic animals played in their life. And but that's why the language of the book, the dialogue of the book is, the dialogue of the film is as it is. I suppose I could say the dialogue of both the book and the film is as it is. It's a very savage and brutal book and a very savage and brutal film. And the book was written by an angry young man, myself, when I was certainly older than you guys in that class, but I was not much older.
And you are already out of the priesthood.
Oh yes. I had cracked up in the priesthood. I'd lost my faith in the more arcane areas of Catholic dogma. I also wanted to meet girls, you know. I was a heterosexual. I didn't fancy older boys, and that's a nasty joke, and I shouldn't make it. But the Skepsi, all my heroes begin with S. Skepsi, the Sicilian Irish Melburnian boy from Melbourne, came to me, I think, because of our similar backgrounds. And I was very impressed with that script.
About the same age, were you not?
We're about the same age.
Just a young man.
He's a little bit younger.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks like an Aussie plumber, but he's enormously brilliant. Even when he's made American films, he says things like Meryl Streep, for example. He says, she told me at a party once that he said to her when he first met her, "Now listen, Meryl, you old tart, what I want to tell..." But that's just the way...
She would have loved it.
That's just the way Australians tend to talk. And Fred talks like an Aussie plumber. So when he's done American films, it's taken the actors a few days. Roy Scheider told me this, to work out that Fred is actually brilliant. But he is brilliant. Now, he had gathered the money to make Schindler. God, here I go again. I do, do forgive me. So many people ask me about Schindler. It's not that I'm fixated about it, because all the questions are
And
about,
for the record, it's Schindler's Ark, not List.
Yes. The Jimmy Blacksmith movie, he was able to make it and raise the money because of the success of his earlier film, mm-hmm. The Devil's Playground, which had great critical acclaim in the United States. And indeed, so did The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. It received more critical acclaim in the U.S. from people like Pauline Kael than it did in Australia.
Now, I would have thought that the success of Devil's Playground was owing primarily to your role as Father Marshall.
No, I don't think that's true. But when I encountered that film script and said, boy, it reads so well, not that I'm an expert on film scripts, but we can all know what a story that works is. Skepsi raised the money for Devil's Playground by going around art gallery openings in Melbourne and selling $5,000 shares in the film.
Amazing.
And he made that film for $375,000. And it was both well scripted, but he also scripted it in on the set, as many good mm-hmm. directors do. So the sermon I gave about the great orb and smilingly tell the poor little kids about the great orb and a bird brushes it with its wing every 10,000 years, and when it's worn away by the bird, eternity will have just started and you'll still be in hell.
And you're smiling now.
Yes. That's the sort of thing we're told when at Catholic school when we're kids, and I believe Americans of my generation were told the same sort of stuff.
Actually, John Barrymore tells a similar story about his upbringing, of all things.
And so we gathered around the night before that scene was shot, all the ruined Catholics in the in the cast and in the crew, and we threw in all the best metaphors we'd heard to make the substance of the script of the sermon. And I actually wrote that sermon. That's my little bit of the movie. That's the other thing about Skepsi. Just because you're a fine director doesn't mean that you're a good screenwriter, but he is. I've read a few of the screenplays he's written of movies that were never made, screenplays based on books. There was, for example, a book by the Australian Booker Prize-winning author Jack Peter Carey, and it was called Jack Mags.
Oh, yes.
He dearly wanted to make a film of that. His career began with The Devil's Playground, and The Devil's Playground was made at a time when a kind of infection came over young Australian film people. Why can't we make our own films? Throughout the 60s, we'd been a bit dejected because the American distributors owned all the distribution, and they were very hostile to distributing Australian material, not out of malice, but because the local managers were under pressure from the studios in the US. And their job was to cover Australia with a light covering of American movies, both brilliant ones like From Here to Eternity and not so brilliant ones. These men and women, this young film student called Gillian Armstrong, who's made some splendid films. There's, of course, the young Jane Campion, who would ultimately make The Piano. Bruce Beresford, Peter Weir, Fred Skepsy, they all got infected with the concept at the same time that it was time.
And television, when television had come along relatively lately, so there was a generation just waiting to pounce once TV was there as an apprenticeship.
Absolutely, as an apprenticeship for screenwriting. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Skepsy made industrial documentaries and commercials. And we make good commercials in Australia. It's interesting. Our beer commercials are particularly good. But, I mean, insofar as commercials are good, it's a little bit like choosing between carpets. But insofar as commercials are good and witty, we make fairly good ones. And Skepsy had made...
Okay, I'm going to put new batteries in. Mm-hmm. This thing uses up batteries like crazy. I'm going to ask you, too, about the fact that so many of the films from that era are about coming of age in schools.
Yes.
It's got to have something to do with this sense of the director's coming of age, mm-hmm. Australian film coming of age.
Yes.
I mean, I can't be coincidental. Devil's Playground is certainly in there.
Yeah, I've got a theory about that.
Oh, good. Let's get into that. Okay.
Where would you like me to start now?
I'll ask the question again.
Yeah.
In talking about Devil's Playground, you're bringing up a fascinating topic, which is so many of the films from that time are about coming of age, My Brilliant Career.
Even Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Later on, Dead Poets Society.
And a very good movie. Yes, Dead Poets Society of Peter Weir. That's a brilliant film. And there was a wonderful...
Getting of Wisdom is another.
The Getting of Wisdom. There's a wonderful early Nicole Kidman movie called The Year My Voice Broke.
Wow.
I just forget who made it, but Nicole Kidman was the... naturally, her voice didn't break, but some boy who was attracted to her, his voice
broke. But how do we account for this? How do we account?
Well, I think I've always thought it's because childhood has great dramatic, and adolescence has great dramatic unities that adult life doesn't have. There are the parents. There is the fixed environment of the school. There are the teachers you love and hate. There's the mutual incomprehension between you and teachers. There's the uncertainty about the other generation, the repulsion and the attraction. And there's the insecurity of approaching other people, more intense, that is, in adolescence than any other time. So adolescence has great, and childhood, have great intensity and great dramatic unity. And you might notice that so many first books are about childhood, from Angela's Ashes. The Catcher in the Rye wasn't the first book of J.D. Salinger, but again, childhood. James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist is a young man. And I think it's that fact that our childhood is something we always want to talk about. If someone gets us in a room and says, tell us about yourself, we'll always very quickly get back to childhood as an explanation for who we are.
Is this adolescence you're talking about, could we apply that to the Australian cinema emerging in the early 1970s?
It might be a an unconscious reference to that fact that Australian cinema was very interesting because, as you know, there is a claim that the first feature film was made in Australia.
Right.
It was made before the first feature film in the US. There's certainly two feature films, one on the Bible made by the Salvation Army and the true history of the Kelly Gang, who were a famous gang of outlaws. And it's an archetypal Australian story. And then in the silent era, there were some great directors. There's a man called Raymond Longford, then spanned into the 30s, where we used to see stories about the bush. We used to see the Dad and Dave series. Dad was a sort of naive country farmer, and Dave was his even denser son. And they were a number of those movies were made. In my childhood, near the beginning of World War One, 20,000 Thieves, about the Australian light horse, made by a man called Chevelle. Very fine film. Post-war, a very good Chips Rafferty film.
Overlanders.
Called the, yes, the Overlanders. And he, also Eureka Stockade. Eureka Stockade was an uprising on the goldfields. So we weren't utterly bereft of Australian films, but it got worse during the 60s. People lost their confidence somehow, and they were making money out of the new medium, television. And then in the 70s, it was time for the resurrection. And that's what happened. And Skepsi was one of the makers of that revolution. He was sick. He told me he was sick of making documentaries for various industries and commercials, even though, and he got the idea that he could use the, his business, whose name I used to know when I was younger and before I became demented, he used his business to underwrite the movies he made, but he also got money from other sources as well.
Did the success of your work on Devil's Playground then lead inevitably to Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith? You worked together?
Yes, he told me very explicitly that he wanted to make a film that was cheaper and more intimate in its scope.
And a whole different tone, too.
And a whole different tone. And he wanted to do that as a prelude to making The Chant. I was impressed by him from the start. He was such, obviously, such an intelligent fellow. But I was also hooked by his personality, as so often happens. He was such good fun to be
kind
with.
Kind of a puckish quality to
yes,
his smile.
Yes, and as soon as he... As soon as he says anything serious about art or film, he has to undermine it with some with some grotesque joke,
yes,
or confession of his own wrongs.
Kind of a drollery.
Yes, so I think to talk about The Chant, I think The Chant had a problem that film has, okay, as a film. And that is, in the novel, you can say how Jimmy is feeling.
Oh, yes.
He's full of utter revenge. It's not in the dialogue, but he's also aware that if he lets anyone off, his proposition that all the whites are his enemy is undermined.
Yeah.
It's like the SS men who let one Jew go. I don't know why they didn't let them all go then. And it is the school teacher MacReady who undermines Jimmy by being the human he is, and who, by being the human he is, actually saves his own life. But undermines Jimmy's cosmos so that he sends his brother away, which happened in real life. So the Australian Aboriginals were treated dreadfully, and they still were in when I was writing this novel, even though we had overwhelmingly endorsed civil rights for Aboriginals in a constitutional referendum to change the Australian constitution. And things have improved since then greatly. And we had freedom rides like you did here, where busloads of young Aboriginals and university students would move into a town and try by Gandhi-like methods to desegregate the town, to allow Aboriginal kids to swim in the local baths and so on.
Well, and how important was it to have David Gulpilil up there on camera, too?
Yes, indeed. It's also, of course, the reconciliation has occurred in Australia through government apology, through trying to do the best we can, not always successfully, and not with always with the goodwill or good sense of all politicians. I was certainly shocked by the degradation of Aboriginal culture, and it wasn't due, it wasn't their fault.
Am I going too far by comparing this interchange of civilization and the Aboriginal culture with the American experience of the whites and Native Americans?
You're not going too far at all. One of the first things that we blamed Aboriginals for was that they were not farmers. Farmers were part of our self-definition, and we felt that if we could get them to farm, we could make them not quite up to our standard, but pretty much manageable. And you in America did the same thing. The question of farming amongst Indigenous Americans, amongst American tribesmen and women, was whether to give in and farm or not. So out in places like Utah and in Colorado, you've got people who did farm and people who wouldn't. Yeah.
Again, I've got it. Like I said, these things use up. And there's also another thing I want to get into, which is the dialogue about federation.
Ah, yes.
This is real important, and I was happy to see as much of it in the film as there was. You've got some great dialogue sequences. Let's see. In the bar.
Yes.
Early on when they're talking about. They're weighing the virtues of... of the unification, as it were. I guess unification isn't quite the right word.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I've got
the people in the small states. It's just like America. The people in the small states thought they'd be overwhelmed by the big ones.
Right.
The people in the big states, big rich states, thought they'd have to sustain the people in the poor states. All that stuff.
And the fact that so many of the models came from Canada and America and all of that. So... even in the, I'm trying to figure out where I put that other.
Gentlemen.
Is it time?
Yes.
Okay.
It's been about 30 minutes that they have filmed, and your camera's out. Battery, is that right?
No, I'm trying to find it. I had another memory card with me.
Do they need this space?
But if it's time to go, well, believe me, we've had a nice long talk.
They,
it's okay.
They were supposed to be done at the end of the last interview, and they're doing this out of the graciousness of their heart.
Ah, good, right. Yeah, so, fine. Good.
Well, that's all right. I'm so happy with what we have been able to talk about.
Give the kids my regards. I hope they understand it all, but anyhow.
Yeah, here it is. Let me take this out and put a new one in.
Are there any other courses in the United States that are taught about Australian films?
I'm sure there are courses that include them.
That include, oh, yes, yeah,
but
include
not,
them as part of.
Yes,
yes,
I
yes.
Wonder if there are any that are exclusively.
Well, I talked
Australian.
To people at the University of New South Wales and Simon Drake at the Sound and Film Archive in Sydney. He didn't know of any over here. None that have been in contact with him. At
and
all.
you were probably a bit gobs.
Question that you wanted to use or sync up with your video, we could certainly stick around until then. But if we
well, actually, there may be one more question, but that's entirely up to you.
If we could do that, we could
say, and I'll try to answer briefly.
We'll do the Federation.
No.
Oh, that's hard for an Irishman.
I
we'll do the Federation thing.
We're just
okay.
Okay. Cool. I'll just jump right to that then. Okay. Chat takes place in around 1900. Interesting date, isn't it?
Interesting date, yeah.
And right off the bat, there's a dialogue in your book about federation. What was that, and why was it being so argued at the time?
Well, like the American colonies federating into a sovereign country, the Australians did the same in 1900. They voted throughout the late 1890s to do so. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a triumph. It was done without bloodshed, and it involved a country that's London to Moscow and a couple of hundred miles as well added on. And I think we're kind of disappointed that we did it without shooting redcoats the way you fellas did. And so there is a connection between federation and war. So the war in the Chattahoochee Blacksmith is offshore. It's in South Africa. But think of Peter Weir's fine, not utterly accurate, but magnificent film, Gallipoli. There, the Australians felt that at Gallipoli, even though we lost, Australia was born, which is a pretty strange idea to think that a nation was born offshore in a country called Turkey.
Well, look at the Alamo here.
In any case, there is that connection between federation, as if we're. But the debates were strong and ongoing, mm-hmm. and the first federal parliament met the year after Jimmy was hanged. So.
That possibility of coming together, and then you have the exchange with the Aborigines and the white culture, seems to me like this is an intentional confluence of things.
Yes, it is. And it's also a reference to the fact that the Aboriginals have no place in the Australian census, in the Constitution. They're to have no place. There are fiscal reasons for that, but there's also racism and they are not recognized as the traditional owners of Australia at all. There was no, it was believed at Federation that they were a dying race and that our job was to help them on either with a bullet or by smoothing the dying pillow.
I could have wished that some of the songs had made it into the film.
Yeah.
those lyrics that you have scattered throughout the book. Those are yours, I assume?
Yes, indeed.
Amazing.
They're based on Aboriginal poetry, the lyrics throughout the book.
On the whole, happy with the adaptation?
The problem of getting inside the soul is the only thing to seeing the nuance of change in Jimmy is the only thing that's hard to do. And I'm amazed how good filmmakers like Fred can put in as much of that unspoken shift of motivation as they can. Okay. I think Skepsi is one of the finest directors. And I look at, I've forgotten the number. 2 degrees of separation.
Oh, 7 degrees.
7 degrees.
Six
of
or seven.
Separation.
Yeah, one of those.
It is 7 degrees of separation. And. Last Orders and Cry in the Dark.
Right.
And
somewhere in there is many. Mr. Baseball.
Yes, Mr. Baseball. That's not a bad
no.
movie. And his last film, The Eye of the Storm, is not. I didn't like it.
It's kind
as
of
much.
Chekhovian, I thought.
Yes, and you're not close to the characters, but then.
Yeah.
It's written by a novelist called Patrick White, who won the Nobel Prize, and it's, I think a lot of the fault lies with White, actually, for his coldness towards these characters. The other thing is Charlotte Rampling. I think you should never put Charlotte Rampling as an elderly mother, because you know that she's going to seduce the daughter's boyfriend, and that's what happens. the eye of the storm.
We're probably going to have to get out of here, alas. But Thomas Keneally, you have been so kind to talk with me and my kids at school.
And it's great to talk to you at however distance. Good luck, kids.
That's wonderful. You are the best. But then you must...